Okay. But what I want, so you all have got a chance to look at the solutions? Questions about the solutions? Hmm?
I can find them on the wiki.
Under today's lecture?
Yeah.
There's some like lecture too.
Should have posted a question to the Slack. Anyway, so if you have a, we can discuss the solutions later, but otherwise I'm going to talk about other things unless there's like a, you all have had enough time to look at it. Anything specific? Okay. Grades were about, the average was around 67, 68. So I was hoping for a bit higher, but that's, it seems. The biggest problem I saw from the look at is that people gave incomplete answers. It wasn't as much, there definitely was some confusion at some points, and I'm going to talk about those later. But right now, I'd like to at least talk a little bit more, continuing where I was, with anomaly detection. So I ended last time on saying you can model program behavior using table lookup. So I'm going to now describe to you the algorithm that I found works on modeling program behavior. It is the stupidest algorithm. And why it works, we can spend a little time with, but the fact is it does remarkably well. It's one of those insights you're going to go like, really? And so I give the explanation actually very simply. Remember I talked about peptides in the biology lecture and said, okay, you can summarize the step, whether a cell is infected or not by looking at the short fragments of proteins presented on the surface of the cell in MHC. So we thought, what would be an peptide equivalent for programs? And so we thought, well, why not look at sequences of system calls? We couldn't think of a good reason why it wouldn't work, except we did talk to operating system experts, and they said, that seems dumb. Program behavior would be too random. That won't work. But it does. So I mean short sequences. I mean, so let's say you have, so system calls are things like open, select, select is on a socket. Change the permission of file. Anyway, but so this is like system calls like this. So you can think of this, there's about 300 on modern Linux. About 300 possible system calls. They're each given a number. So you can think of a program running. When it makes system calls, it's just making a sequence of like 5, 17, 122, 3, 1, 3. So this is really long. I mean, a program can make hundreds, thousands. If it's like a browser, it's making millions of system calls. So how do you model this? I mean, this is a long time series. You do all kinds of complicated things. Markov chains, whatever. Just, let's say we're going to use a window length of 3. So one way to model this is you just, so where this is the current one, and these are the previous ones. So you can make a table of these sequences. So where it's, and this is always current, and these are the previous ones. This is our model. That's it. that's pretty dumb. That's machine learning, isn't it? Building a table? Scarily enough, it is, though. That's the bizarre thing, because programs are simple. All you have to do is remember what happened in the past. And if you see something new, it's like, well, I've never seen that before. Now you might go, well, what if you have different numbers of iterations through the loop? Couldn't that lead to different patterns of system calls? Yes, but normally, if you think of iterating through the loop, you'll have some number of iterations if you have short, a few iterations or versus a lot of iterations. But very quickly, if you go between, you know, one iteration versus 10 iterations, okay, but from 10 to 100, you won't have any more patterns, especially if you're talking about short sequences, because you'll have seen the sequences already. So that works. Basically, if you want to say to learn a complicated pattern, you're like, well, how do I learn it? Oh, I should generalize, just look at things, like, why not just memorize it? This is kind of a stopgap. This, and the beautiful thing about building a table is that you can access it really fast. Now, actually in practice, but I built a kernel implementation of this, I didn't actually do this. I did something even stupider. You know, what's one problem with doing this?
Memory.
Well, what in particular about memory? So I wanted you to have like lengths of like 6 to 10. So how does the storage needed for this increase as I increase the length of the sequence I want to store?
Well, it's exponential.
Exactly. Not a great growth. I mean, if it's a small number, it's fine. I mean, if you're going to do a sequence length of 3 or 2 or something, but if you're going to 6 or 10 or even longer or something, it's going to blow up if you're looking at this, even if you're assuming relatively nice behavior. So there's another problem with it. How do you store it? So we're doing this in C. What data structure would you want to use? I mean, if you had a nice hash table, you could hash all this stuff, but even that's kind of slow. If you roll something really fast, that's a, hash tables can be fast, but it's not the fastest thing you can do. I mean, one simple implementation of this, you might want to use a tree to store it. Now you've got dynamic memory allocation and stuff. I mean, how do you bound the space that's needed for this and make it so you can look up things very fast? I mean, you can have a sorted list, but then you gotta do binary search on it. I mean, it's not that hard, but it's not trivial. So let me tell you, there's a trivial way to store something kind of close to this, which is you just remember the pairs. So let's say if I just had a sequence length of 2, I could just represent this as an array of, and so, 1, 2. And so if I saw a current was 3 preceded by a 1, I'd put a 1 here. And if it's 122 preceded by a 3, I'd put a 1 here. And otherwise I'd have zeros. Just make this a sparse array. And this would capture everything for, just a length 2 sequence. But what if I want to go to length 3? That doesn't quite work, does it? But why don't I just use another one of these arrays for storing this and this? So the current skip 1 and this, you can represent that as an array too, right? And that, if you keep doing this pattern where you just use one array for each pair of the current and a previous one, your growth rate is linear in your storage space. I mean, you're wasting some space because this is a sparse array, but how much information do I need per entry? 1 bit. It's a 1 or 0. And so I can store a length 9 sequence using a 300 by 300 byte array. That
cheap, and every time I want to look something up, I'm just doing array indexing. And you may go like, oh, but that's not exactly a sequence. It's these weird pair thing. It's what, how does that relate? And here's a really stupid thing. That works better than raw sequences. Somehow that generalization is just right. Any of you with a theoretical inclination, I would love to know why. I have this intuitive sense that when you're moving these windows along, especially when they're longer and you move it along, there's a lot of redundancy. Like, this sequence is mostly like this sequence, is mostly like this. I mean, you know, you're sliding over and there's lots of copying between this. And there's no redundancy here. We just do these pairs. So, yeah.
Every time you hit, like, 122, though, would you have to go back and change, like, you lose the previous time you had 122, essentially, right?
No. This is... No, you don't... So, there is 122 as the current. And so what you're... In order to look this up, you have to... I would say, well, what is this sequence allowed? I have to say, well, let me check. Can 122 be immediately preceded by 17? So I look in my immediately previous array and just see if that entry's there. And then I'll check to see, is 122, you know, has something and then 5. I have to look at the next array and check that. And so I mean, it's, you don't lose any information. I'm not quite sure exactly.
Well, I thought that you were trying to save that whole sequence.
I'm
just saying what's allowed.
I just need to say what's allowed. And so this is a generalization. I mean, sequences are a generalization over the entire trace. And look-ahead pairs are a little more of a generalization. So I don't want to... I could spend a lot of time talking about this more, but the thing I really want to emphasize about this is machine learning is very... popular right now. And there's a common notion that machine learning means that you use certain standard algorithms to learn how systems behave. So you might use a neural network, or you might use Bayesian analysis, or you might do all these kind of things, some of which are more complicated, some of which are less complicated. But in practice, general learning algorithms are often too much work. And often, they don't learn what you actually want. And when you look at nature and you look at how things are actually learned, it's mostly by very specific mechanisms specialized to learn very specific things. Because learning happens even at a cellular level. It's not just our brains that learn, it's individual cells learn. Individual cells habituate. You keep providing the same stimulus to a cell, it will react one way initially, basically the equivalent of surprise, and then if you keep poking it the same way, eventually it will habituate and won't react the same way for a wide variety of stimulus. You see this with single-celled animals. So if you realize that sort of adaptation is happening, you realize, wait, how is that happening? It doesn't have these complicated things, it can't implement. It's like, all you need is a feedback loop, really. You just need something to be able to have some state, and then you have to adjust accordingly. And if you can iterate over that, you can do a lot of stuff. The cybernetics folks learned this a long time ago when they were doing, they wanted to make animal-like behavior, and they made it using really simple circuits and electronics. You know, before we had powerful computers, they were kind of building these things that acted kind of animal-like. And that's because they had feedback loops. And if you want to add feedback loops into a computer system, you don't need to necessarily have complicated analysis. You just have to close the loop. Now, computer scientists, I've noticed in general, hate doing this because it violates one of our basic tenets of how we build systems. Which is what? Determinism. We expect to be able to say, okay, here is an input, and here is the output. If you give it this input, you'll get this output. The moment you stick a feedback loop in, You don't know what's happening. And like, when is this algorithm gonna actually detect something is weird or not? I can't tell you. Depends on the exact input. Depends on how the program behaved in a particular context. It's going to adapt. And so, can I guarantee, so I'm saying I detect anomalies, what's gonna be an anomaly? Is it gonna be an attack or is it not gonna be an attack? I can't say that from first principles. I might be able to develop a theory of saying, oh, if you change program behavior in this, you know, in these kind of ways, it will produce different outputs. But that's, you know, it's not deterministic. I can't exactly predict what's going to happen. And this seems to go against our entire culture of how we build systems. And I think we're leaving a lot of power on the floor because of that. I mean, and even when we do machine learning, we still want this predictability. So you want standard data sets that are used to go in to give you fixed outputs. Okay, we've done this, and you're like, is it gonna change online? Is it gonna keep, you know, adapting? Well, if I do that, who knows what it's gonna give? Once I've got it working right, I don't want it to change. So we have our computers act dumb. So this is an algorithm. This is a dumb algorithm. The only reason why this is at all interesting is that it works. And I can only say it works in a very specific context. What really scares me is when we publish this, a whole bunch of people, we never named this as a method. But the paper where we published this look-ahead pair method has thousands of citations. Look it up. It's a paper called "The Sense of Self for Unix Processing." It has thousands of citations. You're like, why does it have a thousand citations? Well, one reason is people went like, this is sequence-based analysis. What a powerful method for analyzing. No, it's dumb. It was literally the dumbest thing we could think of to try on the problem that we couldn't prove to ourselves would not work. That's how we came up with this. We were literally sitting around talking like, how do we model program behavior? Well, you know, okay, well, we've got this system calls, oh, that's complicated. How do you do time series analysis? There's all these common methods. They'll be way too expensive. Well, let's try something dumb. Because not that we think it will work, but let's just think, well, maybe it'll give us some insight into what we could do. Because I came from a group. So how many of you know about genetic algorithms? Have you heard of them? So the inventor of genetic algorithms was a guy named John Holland. He's passed on at the University of Michigan. He's my grand advisor. What I mean is my PhD advisor's PhD advisor. So going to grad school, we definitely knew about like adaptive algorithms and fancy things. And I mean, this is all stuff we knew, and then we proposed something based on table lookup. It's not because we didn't know better. It's because we went like, I can't run genetic algorithms in the kernel on every system call. That'd be way too expensive. We need to start simple. And so we knew we might have made it more complicated, but let's start simple and try to understand the problem. So we thought the dumbest thing we could do. Well, individual system calls, that's probably not enough to model a program. So let's take a small little sequence and try remembering and see what happens.
Often a less flexible technique will be better.
Yeah.
So if you use something that's more complicated, it'll vary more. And the prediction you get will be less accurate. So sometimes number is actually a lot better.
No, exactly. No, this is true, but that's not how we engineer software. We often want to say, I want to make the perfect solution. And so you sit there and you try to think of all the possibilities and you try to design it so you account for everything. And what does that result in? Overly complicated systems that still don't cover all the problem because you didn't understand it in the first place. So how could you make it work? But you tried really hard and you added all these things and it turns out most of the mechanisms you added in probably make no difference except to impact the performance and debugability of your solution. Because we like to think we can design things, but designing things implies understanding, and we don't understand things. And we didn't understand this. I still don't, really. I kind of have some intuition, but I still don't quite understand what's going on here. But it works empirically. And we just did it because it was the simplest thing we could think of trying. That's where I really would more like you to take from this, is like when you have problems, a lot of times, rather than trying to engineer a really complicated solution, try to develop the simplest solution you can think of. That it's not a solution. The simplest way you think you can make some progress on the problem, and then see how well it works. Because that simple solution might actually solve most of the problem. Might not. Yeah. But it's worth seeing, because you don't actually understand the problem, and the only way you understand any problem is by building a solution. So rather than build a complicated solution and then see and show you how much you don't understand the problem, build a stupid solution. But just not stupid enough that it gives you some insight. Because you're going like, well, I think the solution should fail, but I don't really know why it would fail. I have no good basis for it. It just seems too simple. Well, try it. See what happens. And then you'll go like, oh yeah, it failed because of this, this, and this. Okay, now I have something for designing my next solution. This is why Agile actually wins in practice a lot of times. It's nothing fancy about software engineering things. It's just simply, we don't understand the problem. And so by iterating, you converge on a solution. What time is it right now?
11 o'clock.
Okay. I can, please tell me in about 10, 15 minutes, because then we have to stop and give back midterms. So now for your finishing assignment, I gave you all another week. It's still the same questions. I think I've covered everything in there except for insider attacks. So that's why I wanted to make sure I talked about. I mentioned this term before, but what is an insider attack versus a non-insider attack? Would you call it outsider attack? Although I've never really heard that term used. You know, we always talk about insider attacks, people never talk about non-insider attacks. It's a little funny. But what do I mean by an insider attack? Yeah, it's some violating security from the inside of an organization. They are an insider is normally the term for someone who's part of the group. So what this means in technical terms is it's someone who's violating your security who already has access to the system. They may have low access, they might have lots of access. That's not really differentiated, but they have access. They are legitimate users of the system and they are doing bad things.
Does that include people impersonating?
So this is a question here. So a classic insider attack is someone who has access. From the system's perspective, is there a difference between an insider doing something bad and an outsider using stolen credentials to do something bad? No. There's no way for the system to tell the difference. They're both the same thing because they're both people who have access doing bad things with their credentials, which is always the thing that people think of insider attacks as being like this special case of like, oh, you know, we actually trust all of our employees, so why do we have to care about insider attacks? They're all good people. You know, we've screened them heavily. Oh, we've actually done background checks. Oh, we've actually given them clearances. So they're good people, so we don't have to worry about them. We just have to worry about those bad guys who are outside. Right? But no, the first thing a bad guy is going to do is try getting some way of getting into your system using your existing authentication mechanism, and then there'll be an insider, and then you still have to detect them. So intrusion detection was originally developed, the whole audit was to detect insider attacks. Because they knew insiders and outsiders, you can't tell the difference once they're inside your system. So how do you detect an inside attack? I mean, it's not like detecting a buffer overflow. I mean, you could have a signature for malware. You could have a signature for some, you know, exploit on the wire. But what does it mean to detect an insider attack? How are they bad? I mean, maybe if you have a great access control system with really fine-grained things, you can make it so that they don't have access to anything they shouldn't. But that in practice is impossible. Because people need access to do things. They can't get their job done. So if you are an insider, you have access to the system, you have the ability to do damage. Because you have to do your job. So what does it mean to detect them? The only way I can think of to effectively detect an insider is to notice when they're acting weird. That's the only...
What about like where the traffic's coming from? So like if they're using a different IP than normal?
A different IP than normal. weird in some dimension.
Yeah.
But again, it's like location is weird, but maybe they're traveling. Maybe they're at a conference. It all depends on your organization and your environment, what weird means. What's weird in one context is not weird in another context, so it depends on what your baseline is. And so you have to decide what to learn. Now, I've just told you, though, that I can have all kinds of different things that could be weird. That means I can look at all kinds of different dimensions, which means I make the problem too big, which means I can't learn it. So now defining normal again is very hard, and so I'm screwed. How am I going to make this problem more manageable? It means I want to detect weirdness. I want to detect weirdness in a way that's constrained that I can learn quickly. Now, it turns out this modeling unusual program behavior actually can be used to detect insider attacks. Because it's not just for buffer overflows. You can detect buffer overflows. You can detect various, you know, using a backdoor. You can detect other things, but it also can detect insider attacks. Why?
Because we're creatures of habit?
Yes. Because a person normally using, now it'll tend to use, well actually it potentially has the capability of detecting both guys, whether it's an actual insider behaving maliciously or an outsider coming in and taking over the account. The outsider coming in and taking the account is actually a bit easier because they're going to tend to use programs in weird ways. Think of it as simple as the person comes in and they don't know how to use the system and they invoke the help functionality. Does a regular user ever use the help functionality? No, because they already know how to use it. They haven't used it for years. So the program behavior, if you train on that user and go like, they never use the help and they invoke the help, that will be an anomaly because that's a code path that hasn't been followed. Or, you know, someone just going through the menus and just trying random things. That's going to act in a really weird code path that a regular user never uses. Similarly, the insider who goes bad will probably start using functionality of the applications that they normally don't use. I mean, this is particularly makes sense if you're talking about application-level attacks. If someone's just messing around with the file system and doing things, there's not that much semantics or constraints in what they normally do, so you can't really characterize it. But if you're talking about someone using an internal application for doing things, there's a lot of semantics.
So what if they subtly do things from like time over time, so that way there won't be much of a big difference in the sequence?
So when they do things over time quickly, you mean?
No, like it's subtly, you know, like.
So one of the bugaboos of this field is the attacker training the system.
Yeah.
Sure. Saying, "Why you've got a baseline, you're adapting, so I'm just going to move really slow." So you see little glitches, and the little glitches you won't be able to stop me. And if you're looking at raw network packets or something where I'm just injecting things and stuff like that, sure. But if you're watching program behavior, the attacker cannot do that so easily. But why? What knobs do they have to turn? They aren't controlling individual system calls. They're controlling inputs to the program. They can say, I will click on this button, I will give it this file, I will send this network. They are not controlling the program exact functionality. They're just controlling what data goes to the program. And then you're subject to whatever, however the program executes. So the attacker can't just arbitrarily perturb this. So they can't do subtle things. It's a question of, are you going to take this branch or are you not going to take this branch? And once you take that other branch, you know, that could generate a whole bunch of anomalies. That's that insight. Now, will it detect every insider attack? Of course not. Especially if the attacker knows someone like this, that they can make sure their attack looks a lot like regular system usage. But that's hard. That's not so easy to do.
Let's say they can just turn a little knob and it looks normal, but they can't get a lot done by doing that. And then you just sort of slowed their whole attack down and gave you a little bit more advantage.
Yeah, exactly. Like now, if they have to now just do their attack over lots of little bits over time, you slowed them down. They can't just in. But sophisticated attackers, see, if you only worry about the people who can do the most sophisticated attack, most of our defenses, that's not a great way to do it, because most of our defenses break under those kind of situations. You've won if you require a very sophisticated attack to get around your defense. Because that requires lots of resources, lots of time, lots of analysis. You're doing pretty well. And then maybe you could have some other mechanism to help you out. You gotta be able to stop the stupid stuff. Someone just coming in, logging in, and downloading all your documents and then taking them away. Now, I've said this could detect insider attacks, but I'm making one fundamental assumption about this. What's that? That system calls give you enough insight into how the user's using the application. That makes sense if you're talking about a person using an application on a single host. Do you think that works in the cloud for a highly distributed application? I mean, maybe the system calls from many different systems, if you could integrate them together or something like that, but now it's like, program behavior becomes this much more complicated, distributed, concurrent thing. And watching the behavior of system calls in one particular application or system is not necessarily enough. I mean, it's maybe, but it's weird. And maybe, in fact, all the interesting stuff is actually happening at the database level. So maybe you need to model that. So I'm not saying I've solved the problem for all systems. I'm saying that this is one strategy that can work in some circumstances, and there's lots of other places to go. The insight here is that program behavior tells you not just about the program, but about who's using it. It's in effect a filter on the inputs that are given to the program. Why does this matter? Because the world is a complicated place. If you try modeling the world, you're not going to be able to understand it, and the computer is going to have lots of mistakes. But if you can constrain what you're modeling, then you can make some progress. That's what this is. The program behavior is a constraint on the world, a big constraint. It's a filter. I think I'm about out of time. Good? What time is it now? It's like
11:13.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up now. We have the exams here. Are they sorted? Okay. We're gonna work on sorting them right now and then give them to you, so.
And then we will, yeah, so, hold up.